Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 252, A Buddhist Perspective on Psychotherapy with Dr. Mark Epstein.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What the Buddhists say is that we take ourselves too seriously. They suggest that we unconsciously exaggerate the sense of self and that we take ourselves to be more real than we actually are. They don't suggest that we're not real at all or that we're actually empty in the sense of there being nobody there, you know, or in the sense of being void or something. What they're talking about is that there's a way that our own self-importance unconsciously makes us exaggerate the feeling of self, and that gets us into trouble.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Mark Epstein, discussing the Buddhist concept of emptiness in relation to psychoanalytic concepts of self. Mark Epstein, MD, is a psychiatrist and author of Psychotherapy Without the Self, A Buddhist Perspective, Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, and Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. Dr. Epstein is a graduate of Harvard College and the Harvard Medical School. He's a psychotherapist with a private practice in New York City and clinical assistant professor of psychology at New York University. Dr. Epstein has been a contributing editor to TriCycle, the Buddhist Review, since it was founded in 1991. He writes for Yoga Journal, O, the Oprah Magazine, Buddha Dharma, Body and Soul, and other periodicals. Mark Epstein is the author of well-respected books that deal with the difficult and counterintuitive Eastern teachings of non-self, a concept which is sometimes proven so alien to the Western mind as to be out of reach for many Western Buddhists. As a student of Vipassana meditation, he teaches periodically with Sharon Salzberg and Robert Thurman at Tibet House in New York and lectures to therapists around the country on the relationship of Buddhist and Western approaches to psychotherapy. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Mark Epstein, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I'm under the impression that you were a meditator before you became a doctor. Is that right?
That's right. I was interested in Buddhism, deeply interested in Buddhism, and involved in meditation before I went to medical school.
So how did you initially become drawn to Buddhism and meditation?
I took an introductory religion class when I was in college and read the Dhammapada, which seemed very alive and vibrant to me, and then majored in psychology and took other courses that had bits and pieces of Buddhist psychology mixed in, and found a graduate student who was a teaching fellow in one of my psychology courses who was already interested in Buddhism, and he steered me towards people who became very influential in the Buddhist part of my life.
Yeah. Was all this at Harvard?
Those courses were at Harvard, and the graduate student was at Harvard.
Yeah.
And then he sent me out to meet other friends of his who were in Colorado.
Right, right. You were, I noted that you were, I think, is it the Naropa Institute in Boulder?
Yes, the Naropa Institute in Boulder was just beginning, and it was the first summer that they were running programs, and it was like a kind of a Buddhist summer camp.
Yeah.
In which there were teachers from all the different traditions of Buddhism, including the ones I gravitated most towards, whose names were Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield.
Yes,
and they were just beginning to teach in America at that point.
Wow. And these days you can't look into this subject at all without running into their names. I've been reading your 2007 book of essays, Psychotherapy Without the Self, and it largely examines psychoanalytic concepts from a Buddhist perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I got my own PhD from the University of Michigan, which at the time was very psychoanalytic as well. Mm-hmm. So I've really been interested in the translations between, you know, shuttling back and forth between the two systems of thought that you do. Did you go on to get formal psychoanalytic training?
I'm not a psychoanalyst, but a number of my best teachers and supervisors were all psychoanalysts. During my psychiatric residency and so on. And then I read widely in order to do my own writings, but I'm not a psychoanalyst. My own psychotherapists were all Gestalt therapists.
Oh, that's fascinating. Clearly you did read widely and deeply because, you know, you do some very impressive and careful thinking as you examine the two systems of thought, Buddhism and psychoanalytic thought. I've also looked at a previous book of yours, Thoughts Without a Thinker. And then there's this one that I've been reading, Psychotherapy Without the Self. So it seems that there is this theme of without, without a thinker, without a self. What is it that we're getting rid of with this without, and why is that important?
Well, you failed to mention another work, which is entitled Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart.
Okay.
So the thing that we're trying to get rid of is the sense of falling apart, you know, is the sense of there being something the matter with us, a sense of being adrift in a vast sea and alone, lonely, unworthy, self-hatred. All of those phrases speak to a quality of unsatisfactoriness that that often just under the surface is operating in many people.
Yeah, doesn't this also relate to the Buddhist idea of emptiness? I think that's something you also explore.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you mean by the Buddhist idea of emptiness?
Well, I'm not sure what I mean, but I thought I encountered it in your writing.
How did it look to you?
Talking about the void and so on, and I just wanted to get your reflections on the Buddhist idea of emptiness and whether or not there's any corresponding notion in psychoanalytic thought.
Well, what the Buddhists say is that we take ourselves too seriously. They suggest that we unconsciously exaggerate the sense of self, and that we take ourselves to be more real than we actually are. They don't suggest that we're not real at all or that we're actually empty in the sense of there being nobody there, you know, or in the sense of being void or something. What they're talking about is that there's a way that our own self-importance unconsciously makes us exaggerate the feeling of self, and that that gets us into trouble. And the word that they use to describe what's translated as emptiness actually has its root. The Sanskrit word is shunyata, but then the root is shvi, which means a pregnant womb. So the emptiness of Buddhism is really a kind of full emptiness, the same way a pregnant womb is actually full. It's full of the potential that's already there.
Yes, I like the way that you explored that concept, too, in relation to creativity in the final chapter of Psychotherapy Without a Self, where you look at the work of John Cage and others who were influenced by Zen and by D.T. Suzuki in particular.
Mm-hmm. John Cage, Philip Guston, a painter named Agnes Martin, psychoanalysts like Eric Fromm and Karen Horney, Thomas Merton, they all attended these lectures in the early 1950s that D.T. Suzuki, who was a Japanese Zen philosopher, gave at Columbia University. And they took his ideas, and it really affected how they made their work.
Yes. Yeah, I was just looking, actually, I was watching a Charlie Rose interview with a I think it was a sculptor and a painter, and I don't know their names.
Oh, yeah, it was the Charlie Rose interview was with Richard Serra.
Yes.
And Chuck Close. My daughter was working on that show, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing. And it seemed like they were kind of trying to articulate something very similar. I don't know if they were also in that seminar series or not.
They weren't in that seminar series, but they read... They read some of the writings by people like Franz Kline, who were affected by those teachings. It really infiltrated the whole contemporary art world. Those lectures of D.T. Suzuki. So you hear language from contemporary artists that often one thread comes out of Zen, although they may not know it.
Yes, that's fascinating. And I was happy to see in Thoughts Without a Thinker that you noted a similarity between psychoanalytic free association and meditation, because I had had a similar impression on my own. In fact, you note that Freud described a kind of hovering attention himself. Can you take us through that a bit?
Well, Freud on several occasions was asked by his followers to write down instructions for them. He didn't do it very often, and he didn't really want to do it because he wanted people to discover it for themselves. But several times he wrote papers, recommendations for physicians practicing psychoanalysis, in which he actually described his method or his technique. And he said, for instance, the psychoanalyst should suspend judgment and give impartial attention to everything there is to observe. And he said also that the psychoanalyst should simply listen and not bother about whether he or she is keeping anything in mind. And he went on, he described it a little more, but those are sort of the core recommendations, which if you didn't know it was Freud and you just came upon them, you might think they were coming from the Zen master. Freud really, through his own explorations with cocaine and with writing and with paying attention to his neurotic patients, he came to a method of listening which was remarkably similar to what the Buddhists came to 2,000 years before. And he called that method of listening evenly suspended attention. The psychoanalysts who came after him were a little bit afraid of evenly suspended attention. They weren't sure that they could really do it right, and they gradually changed the name from evenly suspended attention to freely floating attention. And in changing the name, they slightly changed the concept of what they should be doing and began to put more emphasis on the making of interpretations rather than on the healing quality of the listening.
Wow, that's great. I haven't encountered that anywhere else, and I really love that you brought that out. People like to dump on Freud so much in recent years, and the anecdotal report that I've always heard about his free association technique, and particularly the use of the couch, was that he was too embarrassed to look at people face on, and so that's why he put them on the couch. But I have difficulty buying that, because just the act of laying down and, not looking somebody else in the eyes actually puts one in a kind of altered state of consciousness. Don't you think that the same sort of maybe Zen-like wisdom was guiding that choice? Is that a possibility?
Well, I don't know. I've never done my therapy on the couch, either as a patient or as a therapist. I always sit so that we have to look at each other. But the story that I heard was that Freud was worried that he would get tired, and so that's why he positioned the couch that way. Because he wasn't sure that he had the stamina to, sit all day long looking people in the eye, which after doing it for 25 years, I can understand why he might have been thinking that.
Yeah. What about cognitive therapy and mindfulness? It seems to me that maybe East and West are coming together in as much as both are asking the patient to monitor their thoughts. What's your take on that?
Well, I think there are important parallels to be made between cognitive therapy and Buddhist mindfulness. One important thing to remember, though, is in Buddhist mindfulness practice, you're not only monitoring your thoughts. Thoughts are really only one of what are called the four foundations of mindfulness. And you don't particularly train yourself in mindfulness by training yourself to watch thoughts. You usually train yourself by watching feeling qualities in the body, by feeling a feeling tone. It's more difficult to apply mindfulness to thoughts. The cognitive therapists tend to be focused on patterns of thought, and particularly destructive patterns of thought, and they try to bring the same kind of non-judgmental attention to the thinking process that the Buddhists are cultivating in these other foundations of mindfulness. But there are parallels to be made.
Yes. Well, you know, speaking of mindfulness, it seems like that has just that word and concept have become so popular. I remarked to someone just the other day that I thought we might be in a mindfulness bubble, you know, like the housing bubble and so on. What do you think about that? What's your take on all the groundswell of interest in mindfulness and the sort of maybe co-opting of that word?
Well, I don't think it's a co-opting. You can trace much of the influence in mindfulness to the work of an old friend of mine named John Kabat-Zinn,
sure,
who began what he called a pain and stress clinic at the University of Massachusetts about 30 years ago. And John Kabat-Zinn and I did our first Buddhist meditation retreats together. He's an old friend and mm-hmm. colleague of mine. And he made a very conscious decision at the very beginning of his work to not call what he was doing Buddhist, but to call it mindfulness, and to abstract the what he felt to be the most important therapeutic method or technique from everything he had learned, and to begin to teach it to people who he thought could use it in the hospital environment in Worcester, Massachusetts that he was part of. And he asked all the local physicians to send him their worst patients, you know, the ones that they felt that they couldn't help. And he said, I'll help them. And he started these groups where he taught not only mindfulness, but he also taught them yoga careful attention to the body. And he's done tremendous work, so that it's really taken hold in the mental health field and is being adapted by, you know, all kinds of people for all kinds of things. And it's one of the ways that the mental health profession has become interested in Buddhism, because everyone who deals with mindfulness knows somewhere in them that it's been taken from Buddhist psychology.
That puts it in a wonderful perspective. Thank you. You have a chapter on the psychodynamics of meditation, focusing on the pitfalls of the spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
What are those pitfalls?
Well, the major pitfall is that people can get attached to anything. So people do a little bit of meditation practice, and they become proud of their accomplishments, and their egos take over, and then not only are they, a psychologist, but they're also a Buddhist psychologist who meditates, or a psychologist who understands mindfulness. And so the kind of narcissistic recruitment of their accomplishments is underway. And that's a well-recognized pitfall of meditation, mm-hmm. a little knowledge can be used by the ego to bolster itself.
Mm-hmm. Are there some diagnostic categories for which meditation would be contraindicated?
Well, there are some diagnostic categories of people who have trouble meditating, at least in the way that it's traditionally taught. And there are certain people for whom it's better to let the techniques be adapted so that they can actually learn them and practice them without becoming more anxious, for instance, instead of less anxious. The best example of that is comes from the work of a woman named Marcia Linehan, who began a therapy that's called dialectical behavioral therapy. It's abbreviated DBT. And Marcia Linehan was a student of Zen Buddhism, and she was also a behaviorist. And she had the remarkable insight that borderline suicidal hospitalized patients, who the psychiatric profession was mostly afraid of, and who were seen as, you know, so emotional, too emotional, unable to handle their emotions. Marcia Linehan had the insight that these patients were actually phobic towards their own emotions, so that when they started to get angry or upset or whatever, they went into a kind of panic because they couldn't handle the emotional expression that was happening in their bodies. And she, rather than teaching these patients how to meditate, she took the active ingredient, as she saw it, of meditation, which was the ability to acknowledge one's feelings without being reactive to them. And she began to teach these patients in a kind of workbook-like way, this is what a feeling is. You know, and she made flashcards with the words mad, sad, glad. You know, these are emotions. This is what's happening in your body when these emotions are discharged. So she taught these patients to name the feelings and also to kind of systematically desensitize themselves to the feelings, just as one has to do in meditation. But she did it in a, you know, as a kind of group therapy. And those patients wouldn't have been able to walk into a meditation hall or a zendo and do the practice. It would have been too overwhelming for them. But they were very skilled. They became very good meditators in her DBT group.
Wow. I had the privilege, actually, of interviewing her. And but I just got a great picture of her work from your description.
It was so effective that it burned through all the psychiatric hospitals, you know, like, because no one knew what to do for these patients, and she did.
That's great. I was intrigued by your chapter on medication and meditation, which speaks to some of these issues, and you take a kind of a very balanced view, I thought. That Buddhism is not necessarily a cure for all mental ills.
And no, also, it shouldn't have to be. Shouldn't have to be a cure-all for everything.
Yeah, and you're
putting too much pressure on Buddhism or on meditation.
But somehow that impression seems to be abroad, you know?
Well, that's part of the pitfalls of meditation, you know, that people feel it should be able to do everything, and that they're a failure in some way if they're still depressed after they've begun a meditation practice. I've had very senior Zen masters and, you know, meditation teachers come to me, you know, making me promise I wouldn't tell because they were anxious or depressed or, you know, needed psychiatric help, needed medication, and feeling very ashamed that they hadn't been able to cure themselves through the power of their meditation.
You note that Tibetan Buddhism seems to be more aware of this than other schools, and that they had kind of cataloged a variety of mental ills.
Yes, I don't think I was saying that they're more aware of this, meaning of the failure of meditation to cure everything. I think Tibetan Buddhists are as vulnerable as anyone else in feeling that they, you know, their method is the highest and that it ought to be able to be enough to cure anyone of anything. I think there are many Tibetan Buddhists who are vulnerable to that way of thinking. But in their own medical tradition, they have cataloged various meditation-induced psychiatric disorders, the main one being a kind of anxiety that results when people try too hard in meditation, and they say the mind doesn't react well to being forced into submission, and that it rears up like an angry horse and gets more agitated.
Do we have any data on mental health and meditation?
Any data on mental health and meditation?
Yeah.
I don't have any data, no. I'm sure somewhere there's a lot of data.
Right. I just know there's so many claims made for meditation and mindfulness.
Well, coming out of John Kabat-Zinn's work, he's been very careful to document and to publish studies showing what it's good for, what it's not good for, and what kinds of populations.
Yeah. Now, you have a private practice in New York City. Are you in Manhattan?
Yes, I'm in Manhattan.
Yeah. So how has Buddhism informed your practice?
It's hard for me to know what my practice would be like without Buddhism, because Buddhism was with me from the very beginning, you know, before I even began my training as a doctor, let alone as a therapist. But I think there's some quality to my listening that is informed by Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
I hope so.
Yeah. Was that a struggle for you in school? I mean, I would imagine that maybe some of your Buddhist ideas might have been wrestling, challenged by, struggling with some of the approaches, theoretical material that you were encountering in your...
No, it actually wasn't much of a struggle. Hmm. I would say the only real issue, I'm not sure this was Buddhist-inspired, this might have been part of my character anyway, but that I really wanted to... I really believed that... the right kind of caring attention from a therapist should be enough to help almost anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I think from experience of working with real patients who weren't just going to get better because I wanted them to, that I came to see how important it was to understand all the different kinds of severe mental illness, to understand that there were, of course, times and cases where medication as opposed to meditation was really important, and also to realize that the depths of people's anger and hatred was a real force to be reckoned with, and that it wasn't just going to go away because I wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. If I were a fly on the wall, would I see anything that would be different from other sorts of therapeutic orientations?
It depends what other walls you had been on in your life as a fly. Hopefully you might see a little more laughter.
Oh, okay, good. Do your therapy patients seek you out because they know of your Buddhist orientation?
Some of them seek me out knowing of my Buddhist orientation, either because they also have a Buddhist orientation and want a therapist who won't think that they're crazy because of it, or because they don't have a Buddhist orientation but they somehow think that having a therapist with a Buddhist orientation will be better. And then many people come not knowing that I have a Buddhist orientation, and they might, if they're lucky, make it all the way through their therapy with me without knowing it.
Okay, here's a big question. What's your take on the notion of enlightenment?
What's my take on the notion of enlightenment?
Yeah.
It's a very important concept to aspire to, because what enlightenment suggests is that it's possible for the mind to exist free from greed, hatred, and delusion, free from clinging.
I guess for myself, I'm wondering if it's more of an end state or more of a process?
If enlightenment is more of an end state or more of a process?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think?
I think process.
So what kind of process?
Well, I think it's a process of unfolding and continuing growth, and I question whether or not there is an end state that one kind of reaches some sort of final state of supreme connectedness to the universe, wisdom, etc., that they live in continuously.
Well, there's a wonderful teaching story in the Tibetan tradition about Tsongkhapa, who was the great reformer of the 1400s, the founder of the Gelugpa sect that the Dalai Lama is the head of. And at the moment of his enlightenment, he realized that every way he had thought about it before was wrong. He said, it's just the opposite of what I was thinking. So I like to think about that because, usually any way that you could imagine what enlightenment is, since you're not enlightened, is not going to be what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so certainly one of the most common ways of understanding, of thinking about enlightenment is that it is, as you're saying, a kind of perfect end state where you're one with the universe, you know. Or maybe you've disappeared completely and flowed into everything. So you just have to try to imagine what the opposite of that might be.
The final section of your book focuses on the Neo-Freudian object relations of Winnicott. What's the tie-in between Buddhist meditation and the work of Winnicott?
Actually, I'm trying to write a book about that right now. Because the ideas of Winnicott from within the psychoanalytic tradition have been the most helpful to me in my own thinking and in my own clinical work with patients. And Winnicott was wrote very beautifully, very poetically about the kind of attention that young children need from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a relationship between the kind of attention that Winnicott talked about. He was the one who coined the phrase a good enough mother, you know, a mother who wouldn't retaliate or abandon in the face of her child's aggression. I think there's a real parallel between what Winnicott was thinking about, and the kind of attention that's cultivated in Buddhist meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's possible to take the discussion in a lot of different directions once you set up that basic equation.
Mm-hmm. Now, doesn't he also make a distinction between the true self and the false self? And I'm wondering how this relates to Buddhist ideas about self.
Well, what Winnicott mostly does, what he mostly does is talk about the feeling of falseness that plagues many people. And he does it at some point call that the false self. But he's really trying to elucidate why do some people walk around feeling not quite real or not real enough? Why do they have a sense of falseness in the back of their minds? And he talks about the childhood origins of that for some people as coming out of the need to manage a parental environment that's not quite good enough, that's either too intrusive or too abandoning, where the parents are depressed or alcoholic or angry or worried, so that the child has to prematurely come into their thinking minds and develop what he calls a caretaker self in order to manage the demands of the parents. And the alternative that he sets up in a different kind of environment, what he calls a facilitating environment, is that the parents are there, they're kind of in the next room, they have one eye out for what's going on, but they're able to give the child space when the child, can use space for the child to play by themselves, to go into their imagination, you know, to read, to make things. And he says when a child has that kind of attention from afar, that the parents are creating a kind of umbrella or a kind of a supportive environment, giving a kind of auxiliary ego support, and that the child is then able to relax into their own selves. And it's that relaxing into their own selves that he tends to call the true self, the ability to do that. That's where the title of my book, Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, that comes from that idea of Winnicott, that that it's possible to let yourself go to pieces, meaning you don't have to maintain that caretaker self, that coherent self, that false self, that persona that you're mobilized to show to the world, that it's really an important thing to be able to let that guard down and relax into a kind of not knowing who you're going to be in any given moment.
Okay. Have you got a title for this new book on Winnicott yet?
I do, but it's provisional, so I'm going to keep it private.
Okay. Just wondering if without was going to be in there, you know, like parenting without the parent or something along those lines.
I hope not. But I might get forced into something like that.
Yeah. Is there anything else that's on the cutting edge for you right now? You mentioned this book that you're working on. Are there any other new ideas that you're working on or exploring?
No, I'm afraid I'm at the stage where I'm only reworking my old ideas.
Okay.
And trying to make them sound new again.
And I discovered that you've worked on some films. Just last night I started watching The Buddha, which I guess was a PBS special that I missed. And Yeah, and you appear on camera quite a bit. I'm enjoying that. And
that's a film made by David Gruben that did appear on PBS this past year. That now I think you can get it on Netflix.
Yes,
he tried to do like a biography of the Buddha. It's about the life of the Buddha, and he interviewed all kinds of people, poets and philosophers and Buddhist teachers and psychiatrists like me, to try to understand the implications of the life of the Buddha. He's not a Buddhist himself. He really didn't know anything about the subject when he came to it, but he made a beautiful film.
So he brought a genuine sort of naive curiosity to the project, which is in the real spirit of Buddhism.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. If you're watching TV, I also did a guest appearance once on an episode of a show called The L Word. Where they asked me to play myself because they wanted to move the main character in a more spiritual direction. So they had her come to a reading that I was giving from one of my books. And from there, she went on a meditation retreat.
Which season? I was a fan, actually, of The L Word.
Season two. Early in season two. It was a while ago.
Oh, boy. I wonder if I saw that episode.
You would have had to have looked very quickly to have seen this.
Okay, that's delightful. And then I found a website that you were on, and it seemed to be about a film. I think the title might have been Spiritual Revolution, but I couldn't find it on Netflix.
Huh. I'm not sure. I have a vague memory of something like that, but I'm not sure what it was.
Yeah. At what point did you know that that writing was going to be so central for you? Did you start off with that notion?
That really came as a surprise to me. I started writing in medical school, I guess, because I had done all these meditation retreats before training as a psychiatrist, as I mentioned, and I started writing basically little articles, academic articles, in the style that I had been reading, in psychiatric journals, psychoanalytic journals. I started writing just to try to explain to myself what these terms meant that I was finding mm-hmm. both in Buddhism and in psychoanalysis. You know, they were both talking about the ego, they were both talking about the self, they were both talking about emptiness, they were both talking about selflessness, and I wanted to make sure that I actually understood myself were these words being used in the same way? Were they being used in different ways? What were the definitions? And so I put these first articles together really for my own edification, and I published a bunch of them in a California journal called the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology,
sure,
where only a very few people saw them. But I collected in that book that you mentioned, Psychotherapy Without the Self, a number of those early articles are collected there. And then I went on, and I had the ambition to publish at least one article in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. So I did. I published one article within the International Review of Psychoanalysis, but it was about the psychoanalytic view of Buddhist meditation. And after all that was published, a book editor got a hold of those articles. Another author of hers sent her these articles and said, you should like try to find this guy. He's doing something sort of interesting. And she contacted me, and that's when I wrote Thoughts About a Thinker. She convinced me that I could write a book.
Well, that's wonderful. She was right.
I'm very grateful to her. She was a wonderful editor.
Yeah. Well, we've come to a good place probably to wrap it up. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
No, I think you've done a good enough job, and I'm happy to leave it in your hands.
Okay, I'm a good enough interviewer. Dr. Mark Epstein, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome. I think it went well. You asked very good questions.
Oh, thank you. I hope you enjoyed this interview with noted Buddhist author, Dr. Mark Epstein. It was a real privilege to have the opportunity to speak with him. You heard us mention the PBS special titled The Buddha, in which Mark appears along with Robert Thurman and other notables. As you heard, this video program is available on Netflix both as a DVD rental as well as real-time streaming if you have a Netflix account. And you heard that he also had a brief appearance on The L Word. If anybody figures out the season and episode, I'd be curious to see if I could find that episode on Netflix and check it out. So if you're interested in meditation, and especially the crossovers between psychodynamic and Buddhist thinking, you'll definitely want to read one or more of Dr. Epstein's books. He's a very careful thinker, and his writing reveals subtle distinctions with amazing clarity. I strongly recommend his books to you.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember, what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind.
Hello all, it's another rainy day here in Northern California. Actually, it's been alternating glorious sunshine with rain showers. As a change of pace from my normal morning routine, I just got back from breakfast out at a local diner with one of my good friends. This past week, I posted part two of my Psychology Today article on the backlash against positive psychology. In this latest blog post, I do a critique of an article by author and psychotherapist Gary Greenberg that appeared in the October 2010 issue of Harper's Magazine. His is the lead article, and it's titled "The War on Unhappiness: Goodbye Freud, Hello Positive Thinking." Part of what I did in my own blog post was to defend three of my past interview guests who I thought were somewhat misrepresented in Greenberg's piece. The three were psychoanalyst Dr. Otto Kernberg and Dr. Scott D. Miller and Stanford psychiatrist Dr. David Burns. I sent a copy of the blog to Dr. Miller and to Dr. Burns and received very gratifying replies from both. I encourage you to read that blog post. You can find it just by Googling The Happiness Dispatch. I have a new interview up on my WiseCounselPodcast.com series. It's an anonymous interview with, quotes, John Doe, a young man who killed a cabbie during a holdup in his youth. And having served his time in prison and grown in the process, he's now on the road to helping others, hoping one day to become a counselor himself. I think you'll find it both interesting and inspiring. Now, don't forget, we also have a store tab on our site where you can purchase three archival CDs covering the first 75 episodes of this show. And each of the three CDs is just $9.95 plus shipping. In addition, if you need CE units, we have two APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to these podcasts. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And while you're on the site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, that's the numeral 4, inkjets.com, and shoebuy.com. And as I've mentioned in the past, I myself have saved money on printer ink at 4inkjets.com and the dress shoes that I ordered from shoebuy.com. You know what they say, if the shoe fits, wear it. Well, in this case, if the shoe doesn't fit, send it back to shoebuy.com for exchange or refund at no shipping charge. Do be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, and strangers in the street. I know that there's a bigger potential listenership out there. Don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite interviews. We've got some new transcripts up on the site thanks to super transcriber Joe Kelly. There's number 251. That's the one just before this one, on mindfulness and psychotherapy with Dr. Patrick Thornton. It's all typed up there for you. Transcript number 37, psychology and longevity with Dr. Norman Shealy, going way back to, I think, 2005 or 2006. And number 57, The Healing Power of Forgiveness with Dr. Fred Luskin. These transcripts add great value, I think. If you are pressed for time, or if you're a student who needs great quotes for that paper you're writing, the transcripts are invaluable. I think I'm going to find them very useful as I compose my Psychology Today blog posts, and I'll be able to go back and very quickly pull out great quotes for my blog. And most of the interviews on Shrink Wrap Radio do have transcripts, thanks to volunteer transcribers like Joe Kelly and others. So with this tremendous value in mind of access to at 252 episodes here to date, and most of them with transcripts, please consider making either a one-time or a continuing donation. You wouldn't believe all the time I put into these shows. For example, a recent guest, I won't say who, unconsciously inserted an into every other sentence they uttered. It would have been very distracting and boring to listen to if I left it in that raw state. So I spent a number of hours painstakingly removing each and every one of those just so that you would have a better listening experience. So if you haven't done so, go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And thanks.
Hi, this is Harvard lecturer, creativity researcher, and author Dr. Shelley Carson, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Shelley Carson, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. Well, that psychodynamic conference in Sydney, Australia that I've been announcing has now come and gone. You'll recall that it was featuring Dr. Jonathan Shedler, who was on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 236 on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapies. And also another presenter and organizer was Peter B. Todd from Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 240 on unconscious mental factors in HIV infection. In fact, Peter B. Todd recently sent me the following note. Dear David, many thanks for your support and generous encouragement during your podcast of the symposium last weekend on the empirical verification of psychoanalytic theory and practice. I want you to know that the presentations of Jonathan Shedler were scintillating and inspiring for participants while promoting the evidence base for psychodynamic psychotherapy in this country. Perhaps you might consider a future podcast on the theme Psychoanalysis Down Under with Jonathan Shedler, Ph.D. My own presentation on operational analysis and measurement and the construct validation of psychoanalysis was well received. I look forward to future podcasts in your Shrink Wrap Radio series. Kind regards, Peter B. Todd. Peter, thank you for that update, and I'm really glad to hear that that conference went so well. And also, Peter distributed flyers advertising Shrink Wrap Radio, and I think I've seen a little bump in the numbers, and maybe that's where they've come from. I can't tell, but it looks like I might have about 100 more subscribers than I had a couple of months ago. So if that's the case, Peter, I do thank you for that, and I'm glad to hear that that conference was so successful. Next, we hear from Michelle, who writes, I discovered you a month ago, and already I filled up a whole shelf on my bookcase with books I learned about from your interviews. I'm now addicted to your program. Hey, good. I'm glad. My iPod contains 60-plus of your podcasts and not a single song. I'm working on an MS in clinical psychology at Notre Dame. That would be a Master of Science in clinical psychology at Notre Dame, the Namur. I'm not sure where the Namur is. So your interviews of people in the profession help a lot. Moreover, I particularly appreciate your honesty, which comes through loud and clear. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, and keep up the good work. Take care. And that's from Michelle. And Michelle, I hope you will help to evangelize Shrink Wrap Radio to your fellow students. It really thrills me when I find that there are students out there, both undergraduate and graduate, who are able to make good use of these interviews, because I think there's lots of important material here that can be of good use to students. And that's certainly one of the driving motivations for me. Here's one from another David who writes, Dr. Dave, I'm a grad student in Russian and Eastern European studies with a huge interest in psychology and sociology. I went through a 4 to 5 year therapy with a psychodynamic therapist myself. One of the major issues I'm drawn to in studying the East is the extent to which the heritage of the Enlightenment has penetrated its cultures. The Ottoman and later communist empires were massive barriers to the penetration of the best of Western ideas to the East. Now that these regions of Europe are becoming more open to global interaction, we might expect to see a further promulgation of such practices as psychology. Anyway, I'd be extremely excited if you could perhaps find time to interview someone with their feet in the Eastern European milieu who practices / researches psychoanalysis and psychotherapy in general. I know that there are large Russian populations in New York, London, and Paris, Perhaps there are famous practitioners there who are from immigrant backgrounds who've had the chance to have deep interaction with Western-style psychotherapy. I would love to learn more about psychotherapy in these Eastern cultures. Thanks. And that's from David. Well, David, that's kind of a rarefied topic. It's an interesting question that you're raising. And I do know that psychoanalytic thought was suppressed during the communist regime, and that the only official psychology was classical, based on classical conditioning. So if there's somebody out there who's got a good resource that they can refer us to on this topic, why, let us know. And finally, here's one more. This one is from Steve, and it was posted to our Yahoo discussion group. And if you'd like to join our Yahoo discussion group, you will find a link on the website to do so. So Steve writes, "Dr. Dave, I was familiar with Jung and Dr. Hollis from some of your past shows, and indeed I expect you are one of the people who most enthused me about pursuing a greater understanding of the work of both men. After hearing your interview, I nearly immediately purchased both The Middle Passage and Under Saturn's Shadow. All I can say is I could not put them down. They are some of the most underlined and self-annotated books in my possession. Dr. Hollis is an exceptional writer, and I pull wonderful insights out of each reading. Thank you for the interview, and thank you for Shrink Wrap Radio. Best regards, Steve." Steve, I'm so glad to hear that. And I guess we've heard from two different listeners here that they purchased books as a result of listening to these shows. Too bad I don't have a good deal with a book publisher. For a while, I was doing the Amazon associate thing, but really, they pay so little that it wasn't worth my time creating the links. So that's why I didn't keep that up. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Mark Epstein for his generosity in sharing his Buddhist perspective on psychotherapy. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Harvard lecturer and author Dr. Shelley Carson. We'll be discussing her book, Your Creative Brain, based on scientific findings from studies involving brain imaging, brain injury cases, neuropsychological testing, and interviews with hundreds of highly creative individuals. Dr. Carson has created a model of 7 different brain states related to creative thought. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.